Schwab Advisor Services is proud to support the RIA Edge podcast and equally proud to support independent financial advisors like you. In a challenging year, how did 68% of firms surveyed in Schwab's RIA benchmarking study meet or exceed their new client goals? By following key success factors, such as leveraging new technology, adapting strategies to win new business and stay connected with their clients, while also attracting and developing the right talent. The Schwab RIA benchmarking study is just one of many ways they provide you with the insights and resources needed to succeed and grow. Get the full picture at advisorservices.schwab.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the RIA Edge podcast. This, as regular listeners to the podcast know, is my chance to speak to founders and executives of registered investment advisory firms that we feel are professionally managed and have a deliberate business development and growth strategy beyond just riding market appreciation, or as we say, growing by design, not by default. And today we're speaking to Craig Robson, who, after being with Merrill Lynch for over two decades, broke out on his own and founded Regent Peak Wealth Advisors in 2019. Craig, thanks very much for joining us.
David, thanks for having me. Looking forward to speaking with you.
Me too. Do you want to just take a brief moment and sketch out for the listeners a little bit about Regent Peak, where you sit in the ecosystem, the size of the firm, the types of clients you serve?
Would love to. Thank you. So Regent Peak Wealth Advisors, as you mentioned, is an RIA who intentionally serves wealth creators, David. And I would kind of bucket those into really probably four categories. Business owners, what we say C-suite or corporate executives, multifamily generational wealth, and divorcees, which maybe doesn't seem like a wealth creator, but in certain situations, there's a lot of what I would say transitional wealth due to an unfortunate divorce. So those four buckets, or those four categories, we proactively serve because they've asked us to, in essence, coordinate their financial affairs. So David, they can focus on what they tell us is really important to them, which is typically their careers, their family, their hobbies and interests. And so, you know, basically in the summer of 2019, I decided to launch and create Regent Peak Wealth Advisors because both those relationships I just referenced and our team were wanting more from each other. We're wanting to do more for our clients. Our clients were asking us to do more. And yet the only thing preventing us from doing that was the kind of bank wirehouse structure we were working under. So that was the catalyst for starting Regent Peak Wealth Advisors. I'll stop right there and see if that answered your question.
Sure. And this leads into my next question. And I was hoping you could explore this a little bit. We have heard for a long time about the breakaway broker, the restrictions placed on the wirehouse advisor, and how there's more freedom on the RIA side. You were there for 25 years. Explain to me a little bit about how you felt at the end of that 25 years and the catalyst maybe that prompted your move. You know, we sometimes hear about it's not one thing, it's a thousand cuts. And then there might be like the final straw will be something even kind of minor. But explain to me your thinking. How long were you thinking about doing it? What was the sense back then, 25 years ago? And how did you make that transition? What was going through your head?
Yeah, lots of information to share with you and your audience. So as you, I think, mentioned at the top of the call, so I was with Merrill Lynch for 25 years. I like to say to people, if it was so terrible, I would have never stayed for 25 years. So it was kind of a gradual process. And this is not a criticism of Merrill Lynch in any way, shape, or form. It's more what I said earlier, that just what we were looking for and what our relationships were asking of us, it just was no longer a good fit. So, you know, your death by a thousand cuts is certainly a good analogy. But I'd say, you know, a couple of things just to give maybe your audience some examples of things that we felt kind of restricted or conflicted with. You know, a lot of our relationships, you know, here's a good example, would say, hey, Craig, you know, my neighbor's starting a venture capital strategy or a local private equity firm, and he or she's asked me to invest in it. I trust you and your team to tell me if that's a good investment. It feels very like opaque. Can you help me out with that? And unfortunately, the answer is no, we couldn't. We were not allowed to kind of do that type of diligence or make those type of recommendations. A second one is we hear all about kind of fintech and the tech stack and how the technology is evolving and changing rapidly, which is awesome for our industry and for our relationships and for advisors. Yet, unfortunately, we were limited in using kind of what our firm said we were allowed to do or basically had to use. And a good example would be is, you know, many, many years ago, probably this would have been like 2010, I on my own decided to, with, you know, management's blessing, go kind of off the shelf, that's the analogy I would use, and pick software that I thought was better for my clients. It could be from a portfolio construct perspective, financial planning perspective. So I didn't ask the firm to pay for it. I paid for it on my own. I got their blessing. And we used that for like 5 or 6 years. And then literally like the flip of a switch, David, one day, manager basically said, you can no longer do that. And I said, well, that doesn't make sense to me, right? This is optimal. Our clients really enjoy it. We think it's better than what you're providing me. Can you help me understand why? Of course, the answer is no. So, there's just two of many examples I could give you. So it felt like more and more, you hear this analogy a lot, like they were, managing us down to the lowest common denominator, the new hire. And I was once a new hire myself, so I understand that. But previously, like why it wasn't so bad is I could get exceptions like the one I mentioned on some of the tech stack, not 100% of the time, but most of the times enough to allow me to feel that I can customize things which were best for my relationships. Once it was obvious to me that those days were behind us, then I really had to make a change. Let me stop and see if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And one of the things that we used to hear a lot was that the reason advisors stay in the quote-unquote captured environment or the wirehouse environment was that there was access to services and technology and perhaps investment structures or certain things that just weren't available on the independent side. And so you had more, I guess, arrows in the quiver, so to speak, in the wirehouse world. Your experience with the technology stack speaks to, I think, the idea that that increasingly is not a difference, right? There's increasingly on the independent side as much, if not more, technology, investment options, access to special planning tools that maybe used to be purely the domain of the wirehouse.
Hey, David, I think I stand out for a moment. You're spot on. So, everybody hears about AI, right? And so it sounds maybe sometimes it's a shiny object, right? There's certainly clients and relationships that are fearful of it. We diligenced a piece of AI software last year, which we've now rolled out and implementing on behalf of our clients, which is just additive to our firm. And what it does is it allows us to, in essence, take their estate plans, their tax documents, their property casualty documents, and basically summarize it into plain English, right? Because obviously you want experts to help you in those areas. And we're not trying to replace those experts in any way, shape, or form. Rather, we're collaborating with them. But it gives us a much better summary of a 100-page estate plan or 50-page tax filing return or property casualty document so that we just in plain English, we can understand what it is today, what's missing, what are the gaps. And we have that collaborative conversation both with the practitioner, i.e. the CPA, the attorney, the property and casualty professional, and our relationships. Everybody finds it additive. I mean, I talk to my friends that still work in the wirehouse, and they're like, we're not even touching AI. Like, that would never happen, right? So, again, I say that not working there anymore, but I just shared that's an example in the last 12 months of just, I would say it's just flipped. The independent space, the technology, just it enables you to research. I've used this phrase, test and learn. We may talk about that a little more later in the call. We love to test and learn different things before we roll it out big. We go small, make sure we understand it. But it's certainly been additive to our relationships.
You spoke about one of the restrictions was a client came to you with an opportunity that maybe was surfacing in their set, their social milieu or amongst their relationships, and you weren't able to act on it, and now you can. It strikes me that, speak to me a little about your current client makeup. I know you specialize in wealth creators, executives, high net worth individuals, entrepreneurs. One of the metrics that we look at is this employee to client ratio. And I think you have a very low, meaning good, employee to client ratio, meaning I guess each client can have a little bit more attention from employees there at the firm. Is that a metric you look at? And when you're talking about your clients coming in and having their relationships outside the firm, bringing those into the fold, how do you process that? What's your relationship with your clients like, or the firm's relationship with the clients and their clients' friends and colleagues?
Yeah, you bet. So you spoke to a topic that's kind of near and dear to me. So I'm not sure if I'll answer in the order you kind of asked it, but I'll do my best. One of the things that we think is different at our firm is that, David, if you were a prospective new relationship and you and I were talking about potentially working together, one thing I would share with you is that we will have three dedicated professionals within Regent Peak working with you and your family, right? It's got to be more than just one individual. Individuals can get sick. Individuals can go on vacation. Individuals can be busy. Individuals can be traveling. Right? It's too much to ask of just one individual, right? So surrounding our clients with competent professionals, we could get to really granular in terms of understanding their situation. And our clients feel super well served in terms of that type of model. We all have lanes that we certainly like specialize in within our firm, but we also can cross over and cross train. We know enough in somebody else's lane to be dangerous enough if we have to help out a client in a pinch. So that kind of service model to me is what I found unique in talking to my peers. They don't have that type of dedicated resources and professionalism for the relationships we serve. So that's certainly something that, we intentionally do. And to your point, so there's 10 professionals at Region Peak. And when we look at how many families we serve, we don't think of it as clients, Dave. We think it's how many families we serve. So, yeah, I don't know your personal situation. If you were married and you had some kids, you may have parents that are still alive. We want to go kind of up the ladder and down the ladder is the visual I try to share with our relationships. We want to serve the entire family because, and we may speak to this, it's more about just the matriarch and patriarch. It's making sure that we're educating the entire family in terms of their values, their goals, their priorities, because typically what the statistics will show you is that the next gen and future generations don't do a really good job of maintaining and growing the wealth that the matriarch and patriarch did. And that's usually because of lack of education, lack of resources, maybe giving money too early when they're not financially mature enough or have enough understanding. So we spend a lot of time educating our relationships in terms of why we think that's also different. And if that's different, we need to make sure we've got resources allocated. So that's kind of our resource strategy to be able to serve those families appropriately. I'm going to stop there and see if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And let me just jump on that point before we get to some of these other questions here. With the family legacy work that you're trying to do, explain to me a little bit about how that works, because we hear this quite a lot, right? Legacy wealth, stewards of legacy wealth, helping folks do that. Clearly, this is more than investment management. What is the education role that comes into it? And how does that work? I mean, are you doing family meetings? Are you going into the home and sitting down with the parents and the kids and the grandparents and doing an entire session around the entire family? Explain to me how family legacy plays out specifically with your clients.
Yeah, love to. It's kind of a passion of mine. Something, David, that we rolled out here at Region Peak, I want to say more than a year ago, but maybe, let's just say 18 months feels close enough. So, I'm a engineer by design, or engineer, I like to say. So I love numbers and stats. And, I came across in some training, I was doing some professional development, seeing some of these stats that jumped off the page to me about how Gen 2 and Gen 3 were just, unfortunately, a lot of the wealth was getting lost, as I referenced earlier. And I didn't want that to happen to our clients in our relationship. They've worked too hard, right? So we went about getting, trained and coached from experts in this space, so that we could leverage their expertise and be able to share that with our families. So, I've referenced earlier as kind of testing and learning. It took time to get our competencies and our qualifications up to snuff, as I like to say, before we felt comfortable having that family meeting. And that's what we call it. It's a family meeting. So the process, David, is I identify families that I think, A, would fit. Not every family, or not everybody has a family, right? But most of our relationships within Region Peak do. So we start with who are the families that we think would really understand this opportunity and have this need, right? And we present it to them and we share them why we think that this would be a productive set of conversations and meetings, assuming that there's interest, and so far, knock on wood, there always has been. Then we walk them through this is what the process would look like. We want to speak to your other family members before the meeting. We want to understand what's on their mind. These conversations are really personal. What are things that maybe you're afraid to say to mom and dad or grandma and grandpa, right? And I'll do it in a very thoughtful way that I'm not undercutting or throwing anybody under the bus, or so it's obvious who said it. But here's kind of the things we've learned. And I take that back to the matriarch and patriarch and say, okay, I'm putting together an agenda. Here's the things I've learned from my interviews from everybody, including the matriarch and patriarch. I get kind of consensus on what would be two to three agenda topics that would really be productive for family meeting, you know, 101, as I like to say. And those are usually, let's call them 2.5, 3 hours. Anything lost more than 3 hours, you're usually losing people. And I'll tell you, David, that first of all, the receptivity has been awesome. And the once you kind of break that barrier, like, yeah, you know, we never thought about that, or we kind of really need to do that. Thanks for bringing that to our attention. Once you get kind of the buy-in, then it's just, like I said, mapping out kind of a framework of what that agenda would look like. And then, yes, to your point, we host the family meeting. It could be in their home. It could be right here in our conference room that David got to see. Anywhere that's, of course, a confidential place. And so those meetings are super productive, but you learn a ton, right? And there's things that come up in the pre-work that weren't initially on my radar that I would have put for the two or three agendas. So we had one situation where, you know, a family, a matriarch, patriarch was within their estate plan, was leaving their super high-end beach house, right? I mean, awesome, right? And they're so excited and so proud that they put that in their estate plan. Their kids knew it. Well, when I asked their kids, all of them said, well, I don't think we want it. We're afraid to tell mom and dad, but I don't think we want it. And I said, well, you know, tell me more. And they said, well, we don't think we can afford it. Like, we think it's awesome and generous that mom and dad want to do that. We love going there. We have amazing experiences. But Craig, have you seen how much beach house costs to maintain? Of course, I know that, right? So unpacking that, mom and dad were shocked, like not offended, but like, yeah, we never thought about that. So part of this meeting, this first meeting of this family, part one whole section was like, how will we make that work so that the daughters don't have to feel that they have to keep it when mom and dad pass away, but financially they'll be taken care of so that they can keep it. I'll stop there. That's just kind of what that would look like. That's one example.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's different conversations than I think a lot of RAs have with their clients. The level, when you talk about the high net worth, ultra high net worth wealth creators, the amount of handholding, like you mentioned, the amount of handholding, I guess is maybe too pejorative, but the amount of involvement that the advisor has with the client, it takes time and it takes effort. As you say, it takes employees. You have dedicated employees for each family. How do you combine that with a growth strategy? And you have a significant growth. You've doubled assets, I think, since you've founded the firm. You are growing. Explain to me a little bit about your growth strategy and how you balance that with the kind of time and attention that each family needs. There's got to be a trade-off there in some sense.
Yeah, no doubt. So, you know, I would say a phrase I used a long time ago, and I'm not saying I came up with it, is just smart growth, right? So, or that's having both a growth and a resource strategy. You can't get too far ahead of yourself, or you'll have gaps in service. You could have gaps in terms of offerings. You could start losing relationships at the back door. So you're going in circles instead of truly growing. So by all means, we have a growth and a resource strategy, and I'm biased. I think everybody should. So, you know, to walk you through, I mean, maybe a good example would be so we launched Regent Peak in 2019, David, the summer of 2019, and you know, my launch and growth and resource strategy at the time for my team, you know, I just tried to really simplify it. Obviously, it's just super hard work. Was we have to do three things to be successful out of the gates. Step number one: survive. Right. Starting a new business is very difficult. That's why most people don't do it. There's just too much unknowns, too much fear, too much uncertainty, too much risk, right? But we felt compelled to do it for the reasons we talked about earlier. So we just have to survive. And I told my team, I said, I think in 12 months, we'll know that we've survived, right? And after survival, then we need to get in this kind of, I talked about earlier, this design and test and learn, right? If we're going to start our own firm for all the reasons we talked about, well, let's not wait to start entertaining doing diligence on private equity and venture capital strategies. Let's not wait on looking at AI pieces of technology or different pieces of software that could be additive to our firm. Let's not wait on, this is something I was really passionate about, is adding a consulting agreement within our offerings. And so I'm going to digress here for a minute. You know, one of the things that also really frustrated me in the wirehouse community was that the only way I could charge for the advice that I was providing to my relationships was the standard, you know, assets under management, percentage of assets. And then we would do our best to try to bucket all the other services under. But it felt very just misaligned. And so, you know, at Region Peak Wealth Advisors, we have two kind of distinct offerings. We have a consulting agreement for everything that's really not direct asset management related, some of the things we talked about earlier, right? And then we have a separate agreement for just truly the direct asset management services we provide for our relationships. And those two stand on their own. So again, this testing and learning, like, we're going to roll this out. This is new to relationships because we weren't ever allowed to do it. And if we don't do that, then shame on us. This is why we wanted to, you know, be independent. And then once we get past that phase, then it's really accelerating and executing our growth strategy. So to answer your question, yes, we have a growth strategy. We also have a resource strategy because each year, you know, what I do at the end of each year is I sit down with my key stakeholders and we, you know, map out what the Region Peak vision will look like for the following year. And then we put, you know, pen to paper, as I like to say. We put, you know, obviously everybody has forecasts. Everybody has a plan. That said, I mean, I think Mike Tyson was quoted as, you know, everybody has a plan if they get punched in the mouth, right? Things are going to change. You have to be able to adapt. Your plans can't be so rigid that you just get stuck on them. But we create this plan and we shape the plan. We present it to everybody within the firm so everybody has, right, visibility to what we're trying to accomplish. We even tie portions of people's compensation to those milestone goals each year. And it's 3 to 5. And anything more than 3 to 5 is just is too many, in my professional opinion. That's how I learned. I used to do 8 to 10 goals. And guess what, David? We didn't hit them all because it was just too many. So that's kind of that's how we think about our growth strategy each year. And then you must monitor that growth plan throughout the year. Another thing I've learned, I used to do it like 2 or 3 times a year. And I learned, you know, through going to some professional development at MIT, is that wasn't enough. They advised me, you need to look at it monthly, really, just because you learned a lot in those 4 weeks of what are things you could be do differently. Waiting a quarter or 6 months is too long. That information, those misses get kind of lost. So I'll pause there for a moment and see if that helps or if I answered your question.
We invite you to join us on May 13th through 16th in Hollywood, Florida, for RA Edge, part of the Wealth Management Edge event. With an agenda designed to help accelerate the growth of your RIA firm with the latest C-suite strategies, you'll walk away with frameworks and approaches for M&A, organic growth, and talent development. Use promo code PODCAST20 to save 20% on your registration. Visit wealthmanagementedge-event.com for more information.
So you're calibrating on a more frequent basis throughout the year how you're moving towards those goals. Growth so far in the 5 years that you have since you founded has been organic, yes?
Yeah.
And that's amazing. You know, I think a lot of the growth in the RIA space is driven by acquisition. Organic growth is hard to come by. How do you approach organic growth? Is it, do you have a marketing strategy? Is it, I understand your firm is pretty good at referrals. Do you approach that deliberately with some strategy, or is it simply a ask when you can a client to make a referral for you, or do you have some kind of strategy around that?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot to unpack there. So let's a couple things you said. So yeah, I totally understand the word referral. I use the word introduction, and it's just it's reframing generally the same thing, but the difference is, you know, referral is if I'm interviewing you, say, hey, you know, David, can you, and this is, you know, I've sat in sessions where outside consultants say, you know, Craig, you need to be asking for 3 referrals after every meeting. I get it. Like, you know, you want to be process-driven, intentional. I certainly am. But I would tell you most relationships just like on the spot, they're like, well, I'm sorry, I don't really have 3 that jumps up, or I need to think about that for a while. So you almost put them like, it's not, you're not offending them, but it's just an awkward conversation. What I've learned to do over time is I just listen, David, for introductions. So the example would be, and this happens a lot, you and I are just talking, you know, either we have a meeting or I called you, I wanted to talk about something. And, you know, there's always some small talk that comes in within a conversation before we talk specifically about the business. And you may say, you know, I may just say, well, how was your weekend? And you said, it was fantastic. You know, I went to, you know, maybe I play golf with a neighbor just moved in from out of state. Oh, who's that? Oh, his name's David, right? His name's Jim, right? And so like, oh, but where did he come from? And you say, oh, he moved from, I'm just making it up, right? New York City, what have you, right? And so I just kind of, I write that name down. And then I get right back to, right, the business at hand, as I like to say. But I'll circle back with you in 3 to 5 days and say, hey, remember last week when we spoke, you mentioned about your new neighbor who moved out of town? And you go, yeah, I'm like, talk to me a little bit about that. And you're like, well, what do you mean? Like, well, I'm curious, right? Do you think he might be a good fit for our team? He just moved to a new city in your neighborhood. He probably doesn't know many people here. And right away you get either, well, I appreciate you asking, but his wife's in the business, right? So we don't need to spend any more time there. Or it's, I never thought about that. And I kind of joke, well, you know, that's why you do what you do and I do what I do, right? You're not equipped or you're not in the business of doing that, right? Most times like, well, you know, let me think about that. I'm not opposed to it. Let me put some thought to that and I'll come back to you. And so most of the organic growth that, you know, we do at Region Peak is via introductions, via those type of conversations. I'm not to say we don't ever get referrals, right? But that's a smaller percentage, as I would say. So that's kind of how we, you know, how we've grown for so many years. Because remember, David, I came from the wirehouse community where you couldn't do an acquisition, right? So now to the inorganic growth, you know, it's something that I'm certainly open to. We've had, you know, conversations with other firms, other practitioners. So far, it hasn't worked out for both sides. So I'm still very open to that. But, you know, it's culture is so important to me, David. And for me to bring on, you know, another firm or another advisor, you know, we've got to make sure that culture fits. Forget the numbers, right? The numbers will come, right? It's either it's profitable or it's not. If it's not profitable, we're not going to do it. But culture, does this individual, does this firm, is it a good fit with our existing practice, our existing team? Well, if we're trying to branch out, is it additive, as I like to say? You know, I was trained organically. That's just kind of what I know for my first 25 years. I like to think I've gotten better at it. I'm not opposed to doing inorganic growth. If I never did inorganic growth, I wouldn't consider life a failure because the organic growth has served us really well. I'll pause there and see if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that strikes me about the services that you provide for your clients, and I like the way that you frame this around consultation services, you know, sitting alongside the traditional investment management services, those consultation services, I imagine, with tax planning, estate planning, legacy planning, I'm sure there's some philanthropy planning that goes in there as well. Do you think about a point where it might make sense to, instead of kind of running a network of partners who you bring in to help with those services, bringing those services in-house? I think a lot of advisors think about estate planning, for instance. Sure, they can refer out to an estate attorney. They have estate attorney partners that they work with closely. But at some point, maybe the economics work such that it makes sense to bring that into the firm and kind of own that piece of the relationship. Is that something you think about at all?
Certainly, right? It's crossed my mind multiple times throughout my career. Once again, when I was in the wirehouse community, I couldn't do that. Another reason, very restrictive, right? Wanted to start my own firm. For me, the biggest challenge is not a conflict, but maybe a perceived conflict, or to put it, you know, maybe differently, is there's lots of, for example, accounting firms, big accounting firms that are adding wealth management into their service offerings, and you know, look, good for them, right? But I would tell you, the question I would have for relationships who's, you know, maybe in a competitive situation that's considering a CPA firm that also has wealth management, you know, I'd pretty much just say, look, could you see where potentially there might be some conflict, right? Could you see where potentially that they're, you know, incentivized just to make the introduction to one of their wealth advisory professionals versus finding what they think are the best practitioners for you and your family? And so if I flip that, David, that's the question I always ask myself. Am I providing what's best for those relationships by saying, here's the type of CPA practitioner I think is best for you. And I've got three that are different firms, not under the same roof, not under the same payroll structure. That's important. There's a subtle little hint right there. And I think these are ones I encourage you to interview, and I'm happy to join you in that process. So I won't say never. That's something I've trained myself. It's hard for me to think that we will ever do that because the conflict to me is greater than the cost savings or, you know, revenue share that would come to our firm if we did that.
Interesting. Okay. That's great. Speak to me then a little bit about the investment management side, and something you said earlier struck me, the notion of non-equity investments, venture capital funds, private equity funds, alternatives. I know you're very involved there. I think a lot of advisors are starting to think about alternatives as an investment allocation. How do you approach it? You know, is this just simply a looking for diversification or non-correlation opportunities that exist outside of the publicly traded equities and bonds? And how do you source your alternative investments, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, you bet. It's kind of a somewhat of a passion of mine. So yeah, the analogy I like to use. So you know, non-correlation is certainly the benefit of adding these type of strategies being really, I call them private investments. I know the industry calls them alternative investments. I never really loved that phrase, but yeah, I think private is a better way to kind of position it, but we're really saying the same thing. So if I was, you know, sitting down with you and if I could see you, the visual I use is like pistons of an engine. What I mean by that is, look, it's the few years, and there's some we've had some recently, where all the different asset classes, public equities, private investments, fixed income, commodities, right? Obviously cash, right? Are all positive. Those are wonderful years, but those are the exception, not the norm. Typically what we see is, hence the pistons, the engine, some are up, some are down, some are in between. And I believe one of the things clients are paying us for is to optimize, right, their returns or reduce their downside volatility, however you want to think through that, right? So to your point, non-correlated investments. So you know, once I make that kind of visual that help clients understand that and then, you know, show them some numbers to kind of back it up, once they buy into that concept, then it's how do we go, like you said, execute, or how do we go source those strategies? So there's kind of the perpetual investments or the on-the-shelf investments that we even had in kind of the wirehouse space. And there's some fantastic ones, many of which we still use today on the independent side. But then there's a whole nother set of investments that are out there that, you know, I just never had access to. I gave you like a, you know, a hypothetical, which those stories happen a lot, by the way. So that was the part that was really exciting to me is, again, the venture capital, the private investments. There's a lot of firms that choose not to go in the wirehouse space because the layering fees are just too significant, and they are expensive, by the way. And so that, you know, once you understand why this kind of, you want to have these multi-asset class portfolios to reduce downside volatility and give you different return streams in any one set of economic cycles, then it's how do we go source those. So, you know, we do that many different ways. Obviously, one way is we're going to have conversations directly with that private equity firm or that venture capital strategy to understand what they're doing, how they're doing it, why they're doing it, what their cost structure is, what's their, you know, previous returns, because there's no guarantees of future returns, right? Why are they different? Why are they unique, right? What's kind of their track record references? And then we'll go to other sources to get some additional diligence before we even think about potentially introducing it to our relationships. And so I also have, you know, a full-time chief compliance officer here at Regent Peak. One of the things, again, I felt was really important to start our firm so that we can have kind of in-house diligence on these type of strategies. And then we have a third party firm that we also pay to help us in those type of endeavors. So look, I want to be really clear. It's not like we're diligencing 50 firms a month. We're obviously not. But there's some unique and some really special ones that we've diligenced and put onto our platform for our clients in the last couple of years that clients are really excited about. I guess what most of them said, you know, I've never heard of these, but I'm glad you brought them to my attention. But also I'll tell you, David, it's a differentiator. I'm in prospective conversations, you know, all the time. That's the primary focus of what I do here at Regent Peak, is talking to new potential clients. And, you know, when you talk about venture capital, private equity, antennas go up because they're not generally hearing that. They're not receiving that, or they're getting, again, the on-the-shelf products. And there's, from my experience, some of the on-the-shelf products are really awesome, but it's not enough. It's very limited. I'll stop there.
Yeah, to differentiate your firm, it makes a lot of sense. One of the things I think RIAs fall into is this notion of, we're offering the same basket of low-cost index funds that the RIA down the street's offering. There's no differentiation. So finding some of these alternative investments, I think, is important. Or, as you say, not alternatives, but different investment strategies.
Can I add one more thing? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, please.
I misspoke. Maybe two more things. One thing that I personally have found, and actually learned this from my team, I didn't kind of know it was, I mean, I knew it was doing, but I didn't know how receptive it was, is If you are a prospective relationship of ours, what I would share with you is if you choose to work with us, here's what I could commit to you. Every investment that we recommend to you, either I own myself or I own something comparable, right? And my point is if I source a private equity strategy 5 years ago and it's closed to new investors, obviously I can't offer that to you, right? But it'd be something comparable. So I always like to say, if it's good enough for my clients, it's good enough for me and my wife and our family, and vice versa. If I'm recommending something to you, David, why wouldn't I want to own that? And I didn't realize how powerful a statement that is. But my team members have told me that, it's really resonating with prospects and relationships. They find that really important. So I think that's number one. And the second one is a lot of RAs, what I've learned, launch their firms to make more money. And that's fine, good for them. You certainly have the ability to create more wealth by going independent, being your own business owner. But that was not my primary focus. My primary focus was all the things we talked about previously, like clients are asking for more and we want to do more. I always say, good things happen, right? When you do basically good things for good people. So, I would say that the financial aspects will come. It's really important to just say that there's so much out there we could be doing for our relationships and for your audience who's thinking about becoming an RIA, or maybe just, as you said, kind of just doing low cost solutions. Anybody can do that. I think you put yourself at risk if you're just kind of a one-trick pony.
Yeah. Speaking of, and we're kind of coming up to the end here, but I did want to, since this is a podcast focused on growth, I wanted to ask one more question. Like I mentioned, organic growth that you've enjoyed so far in your first 5 years is amazing. I think most RA firms don't have that kind of organic growth pace. Do you expect that to continue for the next 5 years? And if not, what is your biggest constraint to growth?
I certainly expect that to happen in the next 5 years. And if it doesn't, I put that on me as the leader of this firm. So that's a very simple but direct answer to your first question. The challenges in our industry, and there are many, right, that we deal with every day is the following, right? Competition is always a good thing, right? It keeps us all on our toes. It also gives you an opportunity to differentiate yourself. But for some folks, I think that, they feel like they have to, lower their fee structures to compete. And, one thing I want to share with you and our audience is that we've actually raised our fees. We raised our fees about 2 years ago because we felt just in looking, so doing a real honest assessment that the time and the resources we were spending was not justified for what we were charging for our clients. So from a challenge perspective is articulating why your fee structure is different and why it's best for clients. I have many conversations, David, where, it almost seems like every prospective conversation is, I'm interviewing three firms. The other two firms are charging me 1%. And you're charging me this flat consulting fee, and I'll just make it up, of $20,000 per year. And then you're charging me 0.65% on the first 5 million and 0.55 on anything above 5 million. That's different. It seems more expensive, though I don't know for sure. Walk me through that. And I'll tell that prospect, that first of all, inexpensive to what or in relation to what? I need to understand more what the competitors say they're going to do for you to truly analyze that. But the second one is we spend as much time, probably more time, on our consulting services for our relationships than for our asset management piece. So if as long as I have an opportunity to share with folks why being different is good for them, then I think we've got a lot of opportunities to grow. The challenge is, right, making sure that we continue in a very competitive landscape, have opportunities to speak to new prospects, new relationships. And it's one of the reasons why I hired a PR firm this year is because I wanted to get Regent Peak more, what I would say, a wider web, broader exposure, right? More opportunities, however you want to think through that. We've got a great marketing firm that helps us with content to get our name out there, but we really need to kind of expand on that from almost a national presence. So I think just to put it there, that's a restriction, that's a challenge. And then talent, right? How do you find fantastic people, right, that want to make this a career, not a job? I can tell you they're out there, but it's not easy to find. So we've got to use multiple different resources, from recruiting firms to, right, social media to our existing network of relationships, to continue to make sure that we follow our resource strategy. As long as we do that and we stay just kind of true to our North Star and our vision, I have no reason to believe why we won't have the same growth rates, if not better, than we had our first 4.5 years.
Would you have a plan to throttle back the organic growth if the resource wasn't there?
Yes, because I don't want to, what I don't want to do is two things would happen if I didn't do that. One, I would start to, my team members would be exhausted, right? And one of the things we say is, look, we work hard when we're here, and when we're not here, we want to enjoy time with our families and our hobbies and interests, no different than our clients, right? And so I really want to be able to separate out those two. The second is, right, so I might lose people, lose talented team members if they're working, right, they're exhausted. And then the second one is, I mentioned earlier, having like your service gaps or having unfortunate relationships leave out the back door because you weren't minding the storefront, as I say. Those would be the two obvious ones if we weren't able to continue our resource and our talent strategy, which is paired with our growth strategy.
That's great. Greg, I know we're getting the hook here. I've taken up too much of your time already, but fascinating conversation. Congratulations on the growth of Regent Peak, and thanks for joining us on the podcast.
David, thank you much so much for your time, and we welcome opportunities in the future to speak to you and your audience if those opportunities are presented.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And this has been the RIA Edge podcast. I'm David Armstrong. Thanks for listening.
Schwab Advisor Services is proud to support the RIA Edge podcast and equally proud to support independent financial advisors like you. In a challenging year, how did 68% of firms surveyed in Schwab's RIA benchmarking study meet or exceed their new client goals? By following key success factors, such as leveraging new technology, adapting strategies to win new business and stay connected with their clients, while also attracting and developing the right talent. The Schwab RIA benchmarking study is just one of many ways they provide you with the insights and resources needed to succeed and grow. Get the full picture at advisorservices.schwab.com.